Good evening, everyone. It's been a long time since we've rock and rolled. I feel like I say that a lot on this show. But yeah, we missed a week or two. Life gets in the way, that sort of thing. But you are listening to simply the best franchise movie podcast on the internet. This is The Long Road to Ruin. I am your host, the mandated reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Rattledge. And after much ballyhoo, after much delay, after much pomp and circumstance, Sean Comer and I are finally ready to tackle all five movies of the Jack Ryan series. Jack Ryan, a character created by author, oh, what's his name? Tom Clancy. I almost said Michael Clayton. That's why I went to check it. So, character created by Tom Clancy in a series of books that he wrote that were adapted into movies. Of course, tonight we'll be looking at the first three that came out chronologically. The Hunt for Red October, Patriot Games, and Clear and Present Danger. Sean Comer will be along momentarily. Meanwhile, he's sending me messages from the Twitter universe saying, there you go. he'll be along shortly. So you might want to be wondering, you know, we try to keep up with what's going on in present-day movies and gear our show towards that. You know, we look at some of the more recent franchises out there. So what in God's green earth possessed us to do the Jack Ryan series? And I have to be honest with you. It wasn't so much passion that drove this, a desire to speak about these films reaching out and grabbing us by the shoulder and said, you must talk about us. It was simply a matter of they were available on Netflix. Yes. Economics rules the day here on The Long Road to Ruin. And after a series of franchises that we reviewed, which required me to rent the movies via Apple TV or buy them, I said, I need to do some series that aren't going to cost me any money. So I went on Netflix and I said, oh, look, all five. but all five movies are available on Netflix. Well, that's what we're doing then. Oddly enough, Darkman isn't, but that's a story for another time. So this week and at some week in the future, I can't tell you when, the schedule's all screwed up. And we have Terminator looming in the future. So we will eventually get to the other two movies of the five, subsequently played by Ben Affleck and Captain Kirk, Chris Pike, new Captain Kirk. Old Captain Kirk was William Shatner. This is new Captain Kirk, Chris Pike. And Chris Pine, Captain Pike was a character. I'm tired, folks. You'll have to bear with me tonight. Chris Pine. Pine cone, pine needle, pine saw. All right, so that's what we'll be doing. We're gonna do this show. I think we're gonna end up breaking it up and having to do Terminator, and then have to go back to it. So it'll be a little weird. I usually don't like to do things, but hey, it was like a 3-year hiatus in between Rocky movies. So you know, that's how we roll here on the Long Road. Rule books, we don't need them. We throw them right out the window. So if you're wondering what that sound was when I took the mute button off Sean Comer, and he appears to be in a subway, being on his way down to Lex Luthor's hideout. Let's try Sean again and see if the subway car has passed.
Live, everybody.
Where are you, Sean? Where in the world are you? Where in the world are you, Carmen Sandiego?
Oh, well, you know what? I'm actually doing a merry little bit of adventuring around Phoenix to get a few things done that have been on my agenda for a while, and it means that I have to spend a lot of time outside the Fortress of Shonitude. So I'm kind of taking this old school, and I'm actually doing this podcast from, oddly enough, the very same Starbucks where I started podcasting with Jeremy Lambert in the first place. So, Yeah. Hi, everybody. And by the way, Mother Nature, you hit like a bitch. 115 degrees, is that the best you can do? Seriously? Come on now. It's a merry sweltering time here in Phoenix. But, yes, good to be back. We had to put things off a couple of weeks because real life intervened for a good little while. But we're back. We've watched 3 out of these 5 movies. And, yeah, as much as I love the first one, yeah, this is mostly just the movies were on Netflix thing.
Well, I'll tell you this. I saw Clear and Present Danger when it first came out. I may or may not have seen Patriot Games. I honestly don't remember. And as I rewatched it a few weeks ago, if I've seen it before, I certainly didn't remember any of the details. But Clear and Present Danger was one I did remember watching. And we'll get into this, but I don't think either one has held up very well over time. I remember thinking as a kid, Harrison Ford seems very confused through most of the movie in Clear and Present Danger.
He seems in both movies like he just doesn't want to be there, period.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get into it as we start talking about Patriot Games and Clear and Present Danger. But he's not an old man. I mean, now he's an old man, his role in the new Star Wars movies is quite dubious. I don't know quite what to think of it yet. You know, obviously I will reserve judgment until I see the movie. But back when he did Patriot Games and Clear and Present Danger, he wasn't necessarily an old man, yet his character just seems exhausted. You know, I guess having been in the CIA and I think in the Navy before that, just wore him down, because Harrison Ford is just like, huh? What? You know, and says everything, but I got to go work out, which separates him from Mark Wahlberg. But
you know what? As we've seen, though, you can do a character like that and really sketch it and put it together in an interesting fashion to where you're sort of watching the tension come together of that particular point in a character's life.
Right.
We've seen so many movies do it so much better. In this one, sure. I don't think it's even so much that you can really write it off as saying, oh, well, Jack Ryan is tired because he spent so many years as a devoted analyst to the CIA, and remember that time he saved the free world from nuclear war? Golly, that had to be exhausting. No, it's not even like that Kiefer Sutherland thing where he delivers every line like he just finished running a 10K. He doesn't sound tired. He just sounds goddamn bored.
Yeah. So let's get into it. Are you familiar at all with the Tom Clancy actual novel? Did you read any of this stuff before seeing the movies or even after?
You know what? I first saw The Hunt for Red October when I was in second grade. I didn't know really what it was about. I was exceptionally sharp for an elementary age kid, but it didn't mean that I had any kind of understanding of what the Cold War was or that the Cold War was a thing. I just knew that I saw these great ads with a submarine and bullets and lots of dark, tight spaces and this guy in this slick uniform with the greatest beard ever, and for some reason I just went, that I want to go see that, and I talked my dad into taking me to go see it. And you know, I might not have necessarily been able to keep up with everything that was going on. I seem to remember my dad afterward actually having to explain the ending to me because I didn't quite fully understand it, but I enjoyed the hell out of it. I loved it. I loved the tension. I loved the excitement. I loved there always seemed to be something important going on. And I had no idea that it was a novel before that, or even really who Tom Clancy was. And now, of course, since I kind of, like a lot of people, like a lot of our listeners, I grew up in the 90s, I know Tom Clancy as being one of those great demigods of beach reading. He is never on any sane, reasonably well-read person's list going to go down as one of the greatest literaries of all time. But in his genre, in that international espionage thriller world, you could kind of put he and Robert Ludlum up there alongside each other, kind of the way a lot of people would stack Dean Koontz and Stephen King alongside one another. And then if, just to kind of take up an extra space, you kind of shove Michael Crichton and John Grisham right in the middle, you would sort of have the Mount Olympus of casual reading of the 90s. And as it happened, because a lot of them were great, you know, easy reading bestsellers that you didn't really need to think too much about, and that didn't leave you with too much to really ruminate on afterwards, of course, they ended up getting made into movies.
Okay. As a kid, I actually didn't ever see The Hunt for Red October. It came out in 1990, March 2nd of 1990, so I was graduating junior high at the time, going into high school, as I recall. And honestly, the movie just didn't have any appeal to me at the time. You know, I certainly didn't have a whole lot of attraction to Alec Baldwin. You know, I was more of a Schwarzenegger, Sylvester Stallone-type moviegoer. Still am to this day. But, you know, I mean, Alec Baldwin, who cares? Sean Connery, he would go on to be Indiana Jones' dad. That was what I give Sean Connery as. I mean, I know, you know, people... I'm at the bottom of Generation X, I believe. And the people sort of at the top of it, you know, Sean Connery is James Bond. Sean Connery, well, look at him. Me, Sean Connery, Indiana Jones' dad. That's what I think. So anyway, I was not really like, you know, like a needy type kid. I know a lot of my friends had parents that were in the Army or the Navy, or even some that were in the Marines. And while my father was an Army guy, I didn't really grow up with this big attraction necessarily to all things military the way some folks did. I mean, I did.
I totally did. Because my dad and I both, sure.
You know, did I run around in camouflage and water guns? Absolutely. But I saw this movie with submarines and I went, meh. Now, as an adult, I can appreciate it, but I can tell you that, you know, 14, 15-year-old Mark would have ever seen that. Not enough stuff blows up. and I know that about I absolutely do. So, as an adult, going back and watching The Hunt for Red October, I can certainly appreciate a movie that asks you to watch it. A movie that demands you to pay attention because there's a lot of stuff going on and it isn't always readily apparent what it all means. And it's funny because I say that about movies about the 70s a lot, that were made in the 70s a lot, that these are movies that demand that you pay attention to them. Whereas today we have movies that are more like, you know, spoiled children. They're screaming and they're yelling and they're breaking stuff and they demand that you pay attention to them too, but in all the wrong ways. Whereas movies written in the that came out in the 70s and The Hunt for Red October, which came out in 1990, as I said before. But still, it's that same kind of idea, the same kind of craft, where actors are forced to act, and they're not trying to capture your attention by blowing things up. You know, what's drawing you in is the drama of the thing, not the the special effects and the dinosaurs and the explosions.
That's what I really like about it.
It's a nice palate cleansing movie.
Well, no, but I was going to say, I like the fact that not only does it demand your attention, but once it gets it, it manages to hold it with virtually every scene. There's not really a moment where you're disengaged from it, where you don't feel like there's something important going on.
Yeah, totally agree. Totally agree. So let's get into The Hunt for Red October. All right, so the plot of this, now this stars again, Alec Baldwin as Jack Ryan, Sean Connery as the Russian captain, or Soviet at this time, because the movie takes place in 1984, Soviet submarine captain, first rank, Marco Ramos. And it also stars Scott Glenn, James Earl Jones, who would be in the subsequent movies, and Sam Neill. And so we have this submarine called the Red October. It's a nuclear sub with a caterpillar drive, which renders it undetectable to passive sonar. Ramos leaves port on orders to conduct exercises with the Lyra-class Konovalov, commanded by his former student, Captain Tupolev. Once at sea, Ramos kills political officer Ivan Putin and commands the crew to head towards America's east coast to conduct missile drills. Our hero, Jack Ryan, CIA analyst, briefs government officials on the departure of the Red October and the threat it poses. Officials in the briefing learn that the bulk of the Soviet Navy has been deployed to sink the Red October, fearing Ramos may plan an unauthorized strike against the United States. Ryan, however, and this is the rub, Ryan, however, hypothesizes that Ramos instead plans to defect and leaves to meet up with the American submarine, the USS Dallas, to prove his theory. Meanwhile, Tupolev, thought unable to track Red October, guesses his former mentor's route and sets a new course across the Atlantic. And so what we end up having is a big sort of race towards the middle, where Ramos is indeed trying to defect. The Americans are suspicious and untrusting of Ryan's theory, and you know, and there's a lot of tension in Ryan trying to convince them that he's right. And still the Soviets trying to sink the Red October to prevent defection, to prevent capturing the sub, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of that going on. And, you know, I have to say, it was a thoughtful movie. It certainly did its job in bringing about the tension of the Cold War. Having no idea what it was this was going to be and really going into the movie cold, I was very surprised that the character of that Sean Connery played, that was his motivation, that his motivation was to defect to the United States. That caught me off guard, and so that's as good a place to start with this. What did you think of that, Sean? I mean, it's a driving force of the movie, and it's certainly what causes us to go, you know, careening into the third act. What did you think of it?
What did I think of Connery playing Ramius?
Of the plot element that his plan all along was to defect. Because as I watched the movie, I mean, I liked it, but it almost felt like it came out of left field.
No. You know what? I loved it because it does something that the other two movies, or I should tell, let's just be honest about it, pretty much the other four movies entirely fail to do. And that is, it takes this element of tense political intrigue of the Cold War, and it adds a certain well-fleshed-out kind of emotional set of stakes for each side, and it really draws you in to that feeling of constant paranoia, of constant dread, of trying to suss out each side's moves two moves ahead of time. And it really does a great job of not just setting up the stakes for Ramius, who's played masterfully by Connery in one of my favorite performances of his entire career, but also the fact that in this one, Jack Ryan is actually just a full-fledged character. It's not just another garden variety by the numbers performance by someone like Harrison Ford. You have Baldwin actually creating Ryan as a fairly timid analyst who truly always does seem almost entirely out of his depth, and then, pun kind of intended, and then he just kind of realizes at one point, holy shit, I have to stop these insane assholes from blowing each other up. This guy wants to come lay a Russian nuclear sub at our doorstep. We'll even forgive him for leaving out the fruit basket. Just thanks for the welcome to the neighborhood gift.
And maybe you can school me on this. I didn't quite get how he got to that conclusion, which is nice because, you know, not everything has to be spelled out for you, but it was one of those things, like when I said it came out of left field, it was because I'm sitting there and I'm watching this, and it's like, I think he wants to defect, and I yell out loud to my son, who isn't watching the movie because he's one, where did you get that from?
It's a little bit of Adam West's Batman bullshit in terms of how he comes up with it, and there really is just almost no better way to explain it than that. They're sitting there in the briefing, and I'm actually going to try to look it up and see if I can find something that maybe words it a little bit better than I can. But yeah, basically, what really kind of sets off the eureka moment for Ryan is the fact that the dates line up with the anniversary of his wife's death. And that's really about all there seemingly is to it. It's like, I guess he thought that would be the perfect idea for an anniversary gift. I'm resorting to Wikipedia here immediately to see if there's anything I'm missing. But that's one thing that after all these years, I still cannot quite seem to figure out.
Yeah, I'm kind of with the captain of the American submarine, where, you know, he's looking at Ryan like, defection? What? No. He's clearly trying to attack America. We got to kill him. I'm with you, bud.
It all but amounts to, I think this because shut up. or to quote another one of my favorite movies, who knows where thoughts come from? They just appear.
I like it because everybody, it was one of those like Independence Day type deals where we want to give the alien vessel a virus. What's that crazy talk? More bombs? like nobody believes him. You sound like a retard.
It is like I said, it is one of the great moments of because shut up.
Yeah. But I like what Alec Baldwin does with it because he's convinced, but you can also. But it's one of these deals where, like, and I've been through this with my own job, where you're convincing people who are skeptical around you of a crazy thing that they don't think is true, and they think you're nuts for even uttering it out loud. But you know you're right. You know you're the smartest guy in the room. So you're going headlong into this thing. But there's that 1% of doubt that makes you feel like, if I'm wrong about this, if the 1% chance that I'm actually wrong, what an asshole I'm going to look like. And what havoc will I have brought?
And you might as well call this the birth of the you son of a bitch moment, because that is literally what Ryan says when he realizes what Ramius is up to. It's so cornball and so cliche, but you know what? Like I said, it really is all brought together in no small part by the fact that everybody in this movie is really playing the stakes, note perfect, with just the right tempo.
I want to ask you a question. If The Hunt for Red October were released as a summer blockbuster today, right in the middle, there was nothing between Fury Road and Age of Ultron. So let's pretend for a moment that in between Age of Ultron and Fury Road and Tomorrowland and San Andreas and Jurassic World, there's The Hunt for Red October. How do you think people would respond to it today? Because I'll tell you, there's a lot of acting going on in this movie, but not a lot of action until the very end, where there's a shootout in the OK Corral, that is the submarine.
And it, Mark, it would this would be one of those Oscar nominees that critics love and they get a lot of press, but you can never find anybody who actually went and saw it.
Because I'm looking at it, for 1990, it was a $30 million budget, and it made $205 million. You know, it was a success, but we can't get people to go see Tomorrowland. You know, we can get people to go see a movie with more dinosaurs at $500 million for a weekend.
But the other thing you would have to contend with is the butthurt nationalistic sensitivity, because let's just face it here. These movies could not be more America if you cast them if you recast all the characters entirely with Carl Jr. burgers topped with hot dogs. Okay?
I had one of those recently.
I'm astounded you maintained your vital functions.
I can't remember. Melissa! What was the reason, the cockamamie reason I came up with for having the American burger from Carl's Jr.?
It had better be because you lost a bet.
No, there was something going... Were we watching something that night? Were we watching something, or... I don't remember what it was. But yeah, I came home, and I was like, I'm celebrating blah, blah, yakety-smackety. So I decided to buy that all-American burger from Carl's Jr., America.
This is what you do when you get this part. Did you run out of bleach to keg stand? Well, is that what happened there?
And I've got kids.
Basically, you had nothing else to do? Well, yeah, you have kids. That's why you challenged them to beat your record.
No.
But
your brain continues to develop until you're 21, 22. They should be waiting at least that long before they start diving headlong into brain-killing alcohol.
The point being, it amazes me on a regular basis that Rupert Murdoch has not opened his cavernous Australian pockets to purchase the rights to all five of these movies and run these in perpetuity between the O'Reilly Factor and the Sean Hannity Show on Fox News. Because
I would definitely agree with you on the Sean Hannity Show.
Because no pancakes I've ever tasted so much like America. So if you were to release this nowadays, it would be a huge hit with that crowd. But on the other hand, people have become so insanely sensitive to international politics that you would have such a crying, bawling, conniption fit storm over
the fact. I think my problem is that I don't even think people would make it through the movie. I mean, I think maybe like my dad's generation would go see it, but I can't imagine you could get the summer. I can't imagine you can get 20 to 40 year olds, that age group, 18 to 33, the money group, to go see this movie. Because we're now so trained to enjoy mindless popcorn fun, you know? Mindless popcorn app, rather.
And which is a shame, because the other sad part about it is technically speaking, it is a phenomenal work of art. Again, the way everything is shot so tightly, and in such confined spaces, and so many close-ups, and varying angles, it really impresses upon you both the mounting stakes and the mounting tensions on board the ships, and the urgency of the situation. The sound mixing is incredible. It's a veritable textbook. And it's such a great-looking movie. And, yeah, as you said, there's a lot of acting going on here. And so that's why, to someone like me, who kind of grew up watching a lot of movies in that era, like this and Unforgiven and The Shawshank Redemption and Misery and whatnot. It's an easy movie to appreciate. You show this to somebody that's come of age within the past decade, oh God, you would have to shove a riddle in the size of a handball down their throats to get them to sit still through the whole thing without picking up a phone and texting.
Yeah. They probably love Battleship.
Yes, yes, we can never forget the Battleship.
Last word on Hunt for Red October. Things get unsaid that need to be talked about. Your burning desires, sir. Go.
For fuck's sake, if you people have an attention span and you want to see what a truly great international espionage thriller looks like, see this goddamn movie. It's also one of the few times Sean Connery gets to speak in his natural brogue, and it's just guttural enough to actually pass pretty well for an old, stately Russian man. Remarkably. And also, it's Alec Baldwin before he went Cuckoo Pants and Anderson.
That was the one thing I thought was kind of funny, actually, was I don't think he changed his accent at all. He's like, we need you to play a Russian. Aye, laddie, I will. I'm like, no, Russian.
No,
aye.
No, you know what? Again, he didn't need to, because unlike Highlander, in which he's a Scotsman playing an Egyptian who's pretending to be Spanish, in this case, his natural accent, it has just that guttural enough bass that's a lot like the way fairly nasal German sounds, or even, you know, a bit of a Russian accent, that it fits, and you never really notice. It just so happens to work. And again, it's one of those that demonstrates before Alec Baldwin became kind of a flaming loudmouth loon with an ego the size of a former Soviet bloc country, that he actually really wasn't a half-bad actor. In fact, all told, he carries the movie pretty well. And in there, you've also got some really watchable performances by the likes of Fred Thompson, Jeffrey Jones, Sam Neill, blink and you miss him, and Tim Curry's in there. You've got James Earl Jones, always fun. I mean, it's a great watch. It holds up remarkably well. Can't recommend it highly.
All right, so let's move on to 1992. Still in high school. And we have the $45 million to make and the $178 million box office, which means cost a little more and they made a little less. Harrison Ford takes over the role as a younger, I believe. He's older. As an older Jack Ryan, now retired from the CIA. And I think now is working as a professor at the Naval Academy, Jack Ryan, in the Patriot Games. Now, interesting thing about this movie. Apparently there was some there was some controversy where Tom Clancy was allegedly, and I'll just go to the wiki on this. Allegedly, Tom Clancy was not wazooey about this movie because despite receiving generally positive reviews, the film garnered a lot of controversy during its release. Tom Clancy disowning the film to critics complaining it was too different from the book. Now, I read the synopsis for the book. I don't understand how this was all that different. And I guess someone would have to tell me who's read the book how true that is. But I read the synopsis for the book, and I watched the movie, and then I reread the synopsis for the movie, and I don't see what there is to disown the movie over. You may not like the movie, but I can't say it seemed all that different from the book, in my opinion.
You know what?
Go ahead.
It's kind of funny, because earlier today, brace yourself once more, Sean's going to plug another one of his favorite web shows. I was watching the latest episode of Here There Be Dragons with Nash, in which he talked about the never-ending story. And at the end of this really glowing retrospective on it, he points out that the author of the original book, when he first saw the movie, actually sued to have his name removed from it because he was so disappointed. And, you know, of course, we now know, all of us who've seen it, know that it should be a quintessential part of everybody's childhood. It holds, again, it's another one that just holds up again and again, decade after decade. So that leads me to think that it could be one of a couple scenarios. Number one, we got a little bit of maybe an Alan Moore scenario where it's actually a good movie, but the author is so fond of the book that he just kind of goes, oh, no, that's not the way I would have done it at all. You ruined it. You ruined my masterwork. Could be a case that maybe it really is a not-so-great adaptation of a really great book, which is entirely possible. Or it could be that it's a book that just doesn't translate really well to the big screen. Because that's a thing that Hollywood does. They see something that makes money. They think, hey, you know who else really likes money? We do. We like money. We want to make money from this. And so they take it and decide they're going to adapt it without any thought to whether artistically it works. And I can tell you right now with this one, it really lacks the emotional tension and investment that's kind of inherent to the international conflict they're trying to portray.
So, people may or may not remember, but there was this bit of a disagreement between the Irish and the English, the Protestants and the Catholics, and that dominated the Western European politics for a great many years, especially in the 90s. Fond of car bombs, they were, the IRA. And there were certainly, around that time, a lot of movies where, you know, if you like your terrorists nice and white, the IRA were great menaces, great villains. So there were lots of Irish villains back in the 90s.
And you see, and here's what I didn't understand about this one. Is, okay, you made The Hunt for Red October. You took the Cold War, and you really fleshed out both sides. You really made characters, fully realized ones, as a matter of fact, kind of out of the United States and Russia themselves. You were able to get to the crux of that. Good on you. Which leads me to my question. That was a conflict that lasted decades. The Irish and the English have at some point or another not gotten along for centuries. There's a lot of emotional weight tied up in that conflict. How in the hell did you manage to make a 2-hour movie and not convey any of it?
Well, I'll tell you how. They chose the backdrop of the politics and the violence between the Protestants and the Catholics and decided to boil it down to a revenge flick between Sean Bean and Harrison.
Yeah.
That's how. They essentially took a beautiful, gorgeous, plump, juicy orange and squeezed all the juice out of it and then served you this crumpled up, disgusting looking fruit and said, it's still an orange, eat up, boyo.
Do you have any idea how much more excited I should be about the fact that what you essentially just said is I'm about to watch a 2-hour battle of wits between Indiana Jones and Ned Stark?
I was going to go with Boromir.
And how utterly disappointing it ends up being.
Well, I mean, it's, my it's problem with Patriot Games is that it starts off, interestingly enough, you have Harrison Ford, his wife and his child, on holiday in England, and in the midst of them touring and doing business and such, you have an attack on the Queen by the IRA, and Harrison Ford saves the day by jumping on them and causing Sean Bean's brother to die. And instead of kind of keeping with politics, they made it entirely about Sean Bean trying to kill Harrison Ford's family, because Harrison Ford killed his brother. And it's like, okay, why do we need the rest of this then? Why does he have to be a CIA analyst? Why does, does any of this have to take place?
I also just want to point out that it should be a general rule in movies that whenever Harrison Ford plays a professor, international incidents must follow. It just needs to be a rule. It needs to be a rule as much as you can't powerbomb Kidman.
I mean, he spends once he goes back to the States, there's some, I mean, it's not a bad movie. I mean, I get your complaint about it is that it's kind of lifeless. But I mean, I didn't dislike it. I liked when they were stalking him and his family. I liked those scenes. There was a particular amount of dread, especially when they went after the wife and daughter on the freeway. But then, the rest of it is Jack Ryan trying to get back into the CIA so that he'll have an opportunity to take revenge on these people. And when they find out that they haven't killed him, they're still trying to take him out. And it's just, Roadrunner and Coyote.
Wait. Hang on a sec. So, you have an authority figure who kills basically an outlaw's brother with whom he's very close. And the surviving brother turns around and decides to go on a revenge quest and pushes things too far when he comes after Jack Ryan's family, and then Jack decides to go on the offensive to settle this. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Road Warrior.
See, I was thinking it was the plot to one of the Fast and the Furious movies.
Welcome to the Road Warrior Ireland edition.
Yeah. One of my favorite parts of this movie is actually when he's standing there with them and they're doing an air mission. And it's like, oh, it's over, Jack. We found them. And they proceed to bomb the training camp of the terrorists, which, as it turns out, none of the people they were trying to kill were actually there. But boy, did they bomb those tents!
Those tents will never hurt anyone ever again.
But my biggest complaint about the movie is that the lead villain, and this is what I mean by this was supposed to be, against the backdrop of political tensions between the Catholics and the Protestants in the United Kingdom. Well, you might as well have said this is set against the backdrops of the owls and the wasps from Family Guy and the Hundred Years' War therein, for all it matters, because it's just about family. And even his own people are like, Jesus Christ, we came here for whoever the British politician was having dinner at the Lion Home. They're like, no, I'm here to kill Harrison Ford. They're like, you idiot. there are bigger things in life already. And he's like, no, there aren't. at what point did they have just shot John B and thrown him off the boat? You single-minded retard.
Oh, God. I don't know. Anybody out there who has read the novel, feel free to chime in and tell us if it's so much better than this. Because if it is, guys, I'm looking for summer reading. Tell me. I've been giving serious thought to just picking up all the Jack Ryan books and just going through them one after another after another after another. But if they're comparable at all to this movie, I'm not even going to waste my time. Because, quite frankly, I've also wanted to read the Bourne anthology, too. And I might as well just skip right to that. Because, and it's like we talked about at the top of the show, it doesn't help that I am forced to sit here and say completely seriously, Alec Baldwin actually played a character better than Harrison Ford. Baldwin basically acted circles around one of the greatest actors of his time. I mean, if anything single, and believe me, this movie and the subsequent one did, that we had come to the dawn of the Harrison Ford just does not give a rat's ass era, it's these two movies. Because in terms of movies wherein he actually gave a shit, for a while there, it was pretty much just these two, Last Crusade, Air Force One. That's about all. And I will say this, even Air Force One was better than it had any right being. But, I mean, he sounds exhausted, bored, resigned. You can kind of tell that he didn't think a whole lot of the script himself. And just, it starts slow and it starts slow and gets slower is essentially what happens here.
No, I mean, this is supposed to be in sort of the thriller action genre, and there's definitely more action in this movie than there is in The Hunt for Red October, which really is nothing shootout in a summary. But this one, you've got the initial, opening brouhaha where he attacks the terrorists, and one man with no gun takes down everybody. Great. An old man Ford just tackled somebody in the middle of the street. You had that set piece. You had them being stalked. One set piece where Harrison Ford is attacked in the street while walking from the job, and then the other one where they are attacked. Which, it's not The Matrix Reloaded or anything, but there used to be a day where car chases and Martin Russell's flipping over bridges and stuff. So for what it was, for 1992, it was a hell of a car chase that ends with the mother and the child going headlong into one of the dividers. That's a fun scene. You've got the entire end sequence there where the terrorists attack the Ryans in their own home after taking out the power, and then they go on a merry boat chase. Sends in, of course, on being dying like he does in every movie. Spoiler alert. So, if you like action, this definitely does have some great action sequences. It's fun in that sense, but in between, that's what it is. It's just a revenge movie. It's not even the best revenge movie. It's just a revenge movie.
Our fans out there of the Netflix show BoJack Horseman will kind of get the reference here. It's my reaction to it is one that I've come to share with my good buddy Jeremy. There's a line we bust out from that show whenever we just find something completely unremarkable, totally blasé. We bust out the line, it went to the stock market, it did a business. That's what it did. It made a movie. It made a dollar.
All right. It didn't make a dollar. Less than he on the Hunt for Red October. All right. So, Jack Ryan. This is 2 years later. Again, a much older Jack Ryan, but newly appointed acting deputy director of the CIA. This was $62 million budget, $215 million at the box office. So this is a pretty good success. This one is the one that I remember seeing when I was in high school at the time. By this one I graduated high school. And I do remember seeing it at the time. As I said before, I just remembered, I didn't always understand what was happening in the movie. I just knew Harrison Ford looked confused a lot.
Everyone
was betraying him, and he didn't understand, and he was coming to realizations well after when he should have. And I was like, oh my goodness, someone give him a walking, talking bear with a crossbow and give him a blaster, because he seemed like he was having more fun with that role.
Oh God, this movie. Pancakes have never tasted so much like America. I'm looking at that damn poster. A super serial looking Harrison Ford, literally wrapped in the American flag.
Yeah. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, part of the deal was Sean, as I said before, life got in the way and wasn't able to do the show 2 weeks ago. And I said, okay, that's fine. Just make sure that when we do it in 2 weeks, we watched all, the first three movies, not just the first two. That's what we agreed on. We had an accord, as it were. And I did try. I tried to rewatch Clear Impression Danger last night, and like an old man, I proceeded to sleep through the whole damn thing, occasionally waking up to see that Harrison Ford was confused and in danger.
You son of a bitch.
So, Sean, tell us about Clear Impression Danger and how it tastes like America.
You son of a bitch.
I have betrayed you.
Everybody betrayed me. I'm fed up with this world.
In my defense, I spent most of my television watching time either watching boxing or Orange is the New Black. And oh my God, so season three is so good.
Basically, what we have here, and I'm going to go from the Wikipedia plot summary because I didn't have anything written up right in front of me because this is normally your job.
And I'm abdicating it, like my throne.
You son of a bitch. What we have here is essentially Jack Ryan versus the drug cartels. Yes, that's right. He has brought a moment's peace to the Russians and the Americans. He has kind of sort of taken on the IRA. And now, with this being the mid-90s, it was only a matter of time before he had to fight a drug cartel. It was to be about as expected as Hulk Hogan will fight an evil foreigner. In fact, it's a good idea to just think of it that way. Just think of Jack Ryan as Hulk Hogan, and it all gets so much better. Because what we have here is we have an American businessman and his family murdered by a number of men who were found at sea operating a yacht. The man has been murdered. Just so happens to be pals with President Bennett, and was killed because he has ties to a Colombian drug cartel from which he skimmed over $650 million. At this point, what we have is the president bringing his national security advisor in on the deal, tells him that, in a great big old title dump, the Colombian drug cartel presents a clear and present danger to America, And Censure gives the National Security Advisor just full-on, unofficial, I don't want to know, don't tell me anything, carte blanche permission to kill everybody responsible for his friend's death. And along the way, the new Deputy Director of Intelligence is Jack Ryan, who then has to go before Congress in order to beg them for funding in order to send operatives to Colombia for ongoing operations. The advisor, James Cutter, then turns to the CIA's Deputy Director of Operations, gets permission to do whatever he needs to do to take the cartel down, and in turn, the federal government puts together a black ops team with the help of John Clark, played by the wonderful Willem Dafoe. Team gets into Colombia, Clark runs the show, Benjamin Bratt leads a seek and destroy ground force against the cartel, and along the way, what it breaks down into is essentially a war with the cartel on their turf, which also includes an intelligence officer played by Joaquin de Almeida, who might sound familiar to some of you as being the villain in Desperado. So, nice little touch there. And along the way, it escalates. The intelligence officer of the cartel manages to broker a deal with the National Security Advisor Cutter, in which he agrees to assassinate the head of the cartel, take it over, cut back drug shipments to the U.S., and as kind of a concession, kind of a sort of peace offer to American law enforcement, he offers up some members of the cartel to the government as kind of a token rest to make it seem like the U.S. is actually gaining ground in the drug war. And in exchange, Cutter gets out of Colombia and he stays gone or he be gone. In exchange, Cortez also gets to subdue a whole bunch of John Clark soldiers. Cutter agrees, tells Ritter, destroy all the evidence, cuts off any and all support to the troops in Colombia. When Ryan finds out about it, he is pissed. He goes off and hacks Ritter's computer, uncovers the conspiracy, and then we reach the climax of the movie in which Ryan embarks with a Black Ops team on a rescue mission. And long story short, Ryan, the Black Ops team, they take down the cartel. Evil is punished. Ryan confronts the president and basically tells him, "I'm going to tell Mommy and Daddy Congressional Oversight Committee on you." And he proceeds to walk like a man out of the Oval Office to go testify before Uncle and Auntie Congress. Roll credits. It was a movie.
Now testify. Now testify.
Like I said, pancakes taste like America. We just kind of had to go and drag the drug war into this, and hence we get what...
Well, in their defense, in the mid-90s, we hadn't yet really gotten dug into the conflict with the Muslims in the Middle East, and we had conquered everybody else.
And again, and they did at least create a sense of importance, a sense of investment, and a sense that Ryan was actually embroiled in the international conflict here, and the international conflict wasn't just an afterthought to a revenge plot. So
in that way, it's definitely superior to Patriot Games.
In that sense, it is. I mean, don't get me wrong. it's still a hot mess. It's still a very stereotypical plot line. It's still extremely predictable. You know, my being a wrestling fan, I've watched WCW storylines involving Sting, where I didn't see the double cross coming as early as I saw it in this one. But it's marginally better than Patriot Games. But on the other hand, it still doesn't fix the problem of the fact that Harrison Ford is just—he's clearly so damn disinterested.
But I mean, at least you know what you can say about the first three Tom Clancy, Jack Ryan movies is that really all three of them still capture your interest with traditional movie making craft. You know, because we're being kind of hard on the two Harrison Ford ones, and maybe rightly so. I think we're being honest. But remember, you know, in about a month's time, we're going to come back to this series, and we're going to look at Shadow Recruit and The Sum of All Fears, and those two movies make these seem like Sid and Nancy, or you know, The Deer Hunter, or something.
Oh, God, not the half. You're going to make me watch the Affleck, you son of a bitch.
So, let me ask you a question, and I think we'll start to wrap after this. It's going to be kind of a short show tonight. But why do you think, you know, I mean, as we're going through this sort of litany of criticisms, why do you think these films translated the way they did onto film? Why did these books, rather, these adaptations of these books translate the way they did onto film? What do you think would have made it better?
Well, you know, from what I've seen so far, and I say this acknowledging that I have not watched Sum of All Fears yet, and I have not watched Shadow Recruit yet, but from what I can tell, The Hunt for Red October was the one that really got it right because it took the time in a very old-fashioned way to establish tension, to establish stakes, and to establish how those stakes were impacting the characters. It doesn't hurt that it's cast with an absolutely marvelous array of very capable, if not legendary, performers. But the fact is, this is where books differ from movies, especially when you're talking about an international suspense story, is in the books, you have a lot of time, a lot more time, to build things up slowly and to really kind of drag things out, to play a little bit more with the feelings of each character and how they evolve and how the events impact. In the movies, even if you're making a between 2 and 3 hour movie, you still got to do it more quickly than that. And while the first movie does it so well, it feels like in the second and third ones, they were really impatient. Like they just wanted to get to it right away. They didn't want to bother with any of the actual intrigue, with really kind of watching the trains that were coming down the track toward each other and kind of looking at what's going on inside each one and why they can't stop. And that happens sometimes in books. There are some books that just do not make good movies for just that reason, because they just don't translate that effectively, because in the movies, you really do need to have an exciting visual beat every so often. Otherwise, you are going to lose the audience, especially in a genre like this. And it just feels like both they tried to force that a little bit too much with the two Harrison Ford movies, and also the fact that, again, this was Harrison Ford. This wasn't Han Solo. This wasn't Indy. This wasn't even whatever his name was in American Graffiti. I'm drawing a blank. this was just Harrison collecting a paycheck. And there are moments where he actually puts forth an offer, but for the most part, he just doesn't seem to be near like that that kind of Jack Bauer, embroiled and affected by everything that's kind of going on around him. He's the Superman. He's the big blue Boy Scout of the entire thing. He is that goddamn clear press danger poster. It doesn't lie. This is Harrison just pretty much wrapped snug as a bug in a rug in the American flag. And that's pretty much it. He might as well be a Silver Age comic book hero. He's just kind of
less fish out of water, which is more fun.
Yeah, this is basically Steve Rogers, agent of the CIA.
Okay. I think it's a great line to end on. Steve Rogers, agent of the CIA. So with that being said, let's talk about the future. We had to put off our Orange is the New Black review maybe indefinitely because Sean got very busy. And, you know, we do this as a hobby sort of thing. So sometimes, you know, we just can't get the stuff. But are we ready to roll again on the 23rd?
I believe we are ready to roll again on the 23rd, sir.
Okay. So the 23rd, go over the schedule for the next couple of weeks. The 23rd is Orange is the New Black, part 1 of 4. On Wednesday, Robert Winfrey and I will be reviewing Inside Out from the Pixar. On Thursday is the Metal Hammer of Doom. We'll be looking at the White Snake Purple Covers album, the Purple album, as it's called. No Show Tuesday. I will be at a concert. Wednesday, no show. I will be in Terminator Genesis. No show Thursday. I will be at a wedding. So there you go. I'm off that entire week. However, we'll be back on Tuesday the 7th for part 2 of our Orange is the New Black. We'll be looking at the Terminator trilogy. We'll be reviewing Terminator Genesis July 8th. We'll be looking at the Terminator trilogy on July 9th because it is, in fact, Terminator Week on the Rattlesnake Broadcasting Network. The following week, we'll be reviewing. What are we reviewing after that? We'll be reviewing on July 15th. We'll be reviewing Minions, which comes out actually July 10th, and on the 6th now. The 16th and the 23rd is going to be a double shot of the Metal Hammer of Doom. It just worked out that way. So on the 16th, we're reviewing the new High on Fire. On the 23rd, we'll be reviewing the new Cradle of Filth. And I'll just work backwards from there. On the 22nd, we'll be reviewing Ant-Man. And on the 21st will be the last part of our Orange is the New Black review. On the 29th, we'll be reviewing Pixels with Adam Sandler because I like to torture Robert Winfrey. And on the 30th, wake up, on the 30th is the second part of our Jack Ryan series. So you have a whole month now to do what you got to do and then watch the Ben Affleck and the Chris Pike. So July 30th will be revisiting the Jack Ryan series after a brief interlude with the Terminator trilogy. And you might say, but Mark, there were 4 Terminator movies. Yeah, fuck that 4th one.
Yeah.
Strike it from the
There were 4. There were 4.
Nope. Not going to happen. One show, 3 movies.
I am going to make sure when we get to the Highlander series that you watch the theatrical cut.
Yeah, the television series?
No, we're not doing the TV series. No. No, I'm talking about when we do the movies.
It's on the list, but aren't there like only three or four of them?
Oh, you poor, simple creature. You do not know what awaits you with Highlander 2. I do. I know what hunts you.
All right. Sean, why don't you, go ahead and keep the plug.
I'm going to have a cup of coffee and then go to the gym.
All right.
No, I've got some more stuff that I'm kind of working on, but it's a slow process right now that I don't want to go too much into. I'm just kind of on mini adventures in and around the desert of Arizona right now, and amazingly, it has resulted in me losing 10 pounds somehow. good time to just say thank you to everybody that tunes in. We're sorry about the schedule shuffling that keeps going on, but we like to think the show is just getting better and better as we keep getting into better and better stuff to work with. By all means, follow us on Facebook, follow the Broadrich and Broadcasting Network on Twitter, all of the socials, and yeah, keep tuning into all the shows, and I will see you in a month.
All right. Well, this is Sean Palmer. I'm your mandated reporter, Mr. Mark Rattledge. This has been The Long Road to Ruin. Check me out on the latest edition of the Casual Heroes podcast up right now. It's called Suplex City. Check out Robert Winfrey and I's review of Jurassic World. That's in the archives. Be well, be safe, behave, and hail the apocalypse.